ACE as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Radio. This is Naturally, and on today's show, Elaine speaks with author Julene Baer and with Joe Spees of Sierra Club. He'll speak about fracking and earthquakes. And then Mike Murphy will speak with Jill Stein about 10 days of action, Earth Day to May Day. But first, here's today's news. On April 16th, by a vote of 28-2, the Vermont State Senate passed H-112, a bill to require mandatory labeling of foods sold in Vermont that contain GMOs. The bill also makes it illegal to call any food product containing GMOs natural or all-natural. Unlike bills passed last year in Maine and Connecticut, which require four or five other states to pass GMO labeling laws before they can be enacted, Vermont's law contains no trigger clauses, making it the first clean GMO labeling law in the country. The bill now goes back to the House, which is expected to agree to the Senate's amendments, and then to Governor Peter Shumlin, who is expected to sign it. Washington University students in St. Louis are in the middle of a sit-in demanding that WashU cut ties with Peabody Energy, the world's largest private sector coal corporation. Currently, Peabody CEO Greg Boyce sits on the Washington University Board of Trustees, and in 2009, Peabody donated $5 million to the university to found its Consortium for Clean Coal Utilization, a research entity housed in WashU's School of Engineering. The students cite numerous reasons why the university should end its relationship with Peabody, including Peabody's contribution to global carbon emissions, participation in the American Legislative Exchange Council, marginalization and displacement of indigenous and rural communities in places including Black Mesa, Arizona, and Rocky Branch, Illinois, and interference in democratic processes via their lawsuit against the local Take Back St. Louis ballot initiative. Find out more about this current sit-in at studentsagainstpeabody.org. A new study has found that a small number of gas wells are releasing significant quantities of methane into the air even before they are hydraulically fractured or fracked. The paper, published yesterday in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, is the result of measurements of methane made by flying an airplane over parts of the Marcellus Shale. The researchers detected a, quote, significant regional flux, end quote, of methane, a greenhouse gas with about 30 times the warming potential of carbon dioxide over a 100-year period, coming from an area of gas wells in southwestern Pennsylvania. Typically, during the drilling process, methane emissions are estimated to be between 0.04 and 0.3 gram of methane per second per well. The researchers measured emission rates of 34 grams of methane per second, 100 to 1,000 times greater than those estimates. These high estimates were only found in 1% of the wells surveyed, however. This finding lends additional credence to the idea that a small subset of wells, drilling processes, and equipment is probably responsible for a large percentage of the emissions from gas drilling. That's all for the news.
Well, welcome to Eco Radio on this April 21st. This is the day before Earth Day, and we want to welcome all of our listeners to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. And I have on the phone tonight, from Lincoln, Nebraska, the author of a new book. Her name is Julene Baer, and she has released a book called The Ogallala Road, A Memoir of Love and Reckoning. And she's going to be in Kansas City soon on a book tour, and we wanted a chance to interview her about her book before she got here. Julene, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Hello, Elaine.
And tonight you are going to be in Lincoln, Nebraska as part of your book tour. You are coming next to Manhattan and then to Lawrence, and you will be in the Kansas City area then on the 24th, correct?
That's right.
And I
at
think
7 p.m. at Unity Temple.
Right, and this is being sponsored by Rainy Day Books and the Kansas Land Trust, which is an interesting organization to be helping you out on this. Julene, you're a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop and the Iowa Nonfiction Writing Program. You've published an essay collection already called One Degree West, which won some awards. You've taught at the University of Wyoming and University of Iowa, and you currently live in Longmont, Colorado. Now, the book, the book itself, The Ogallala Road, it's being pitched as, you know, a memoir. You're kind of young to be writing a memoir. Do you think you've reached the end of the Ogallala Road, or do you see more coming?
Actually, as I wrote the book and thought I was finished with it, I realized that I'm nowhere near finished. I've been on this Ogallala Road since childhood, when I first drank Ogallala water from the windmill on our farm that I grew up on in western Kansas, and now I'm very committed to doing anything I can to help preserve what's left of the Ogallala Aquifer.
Well, why would someone who's not from Kansas, who doesn't know, you know, the Goodland, Kansas area, why would they get into this book? What should it mean to the rest of your readers?
Well, there will be lots of reasons. The most critical one is probably how we're going to get food from grain crops in this country in the future. Now that the UN has come out with this new report, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is telling us that we're going to need our aquifers in order to supplement dry land crops such as wheat and the grains that have grown traditionally in these places where we have insufficient rainfall to grow the thirstier crops, such as corn. So right now we're throwing away what's left of the Ogallala Aquifer onto a crop that's not really suited for the region. And consequently, in the future, the rest of the country and the world is going to pay for that decision.
It's interesting that having grown up on this farm, which did irrigate corn and other crops, that the book, it is very much a story of your struggle with what to do with the farm after your father died. And it's interesting that now you are committed to helping to protect the Ogallala. But in a nutshell, what was wrong with irrigating all that corn and making money off of it?
Well, the only thing, well, there's probably several things wrong with it, but the worst thing is that we're wasting an aquifer that has supported human life on the plains going back to Paleo-Indian times. I'm talking over 10,000 years, and animal life before that for millions of years. We're drying up the streams and the creeks because all of those rivers and water sources on the high plains are fed by the Ogallala Aquifer. There's so many reasons it's a bad thing to be growing corn, because corn is, we're wasting the protein production as well, because when we process corn through cows, then we lose a large percentage of the protein. If we grew grain crops that we fed directly to people, then we would be able to feed many more people.
Absolutely. And some of this corn is also going to ethanol because of policy from Congress,
right?
Is it not?
40% of it goes to ethanol.
To run our cars,
right,
out,
so.
I-70, right, to Denver or wherever. You mentioned several times in the book that the farming policy in the country is a problem. And the book isn't all about these technicalities, folks, and I hope my listeners understand that it's also about, you know, a person's life, and we're going to come back to that. But on page 215 of the book, you talk about the problem with farm subsidies, that it is driving abuse of the aquifer. And could you elaborate, maybe read a paragraph or so there?
Okay. The effect of farm subsidies is circular. The draw of federal dollars drives production up, which in turn drives prices down, creating the need for more subsidies. Even if most irrigators don't like the idea of curtailment, they would be far outnumbered by the other citizen owners of the water if only the awareness of those citizens were expanded by open and honest public debate.
And I think that was a critical piece, at least in the book, as an environmentalist, that the need for some kind of regulation in a state where these water district boards are generally inhabited by irrigators. Part of the book is your experience in dealing with that kind of situation.
Right. There's a lot of emphasis on local control, and that's understandable, because you would think that the people who need that water in order to sustain a farming way of life for generations to come would have a great stake in preserving it. But as it turns out, most of the people on those irrigation boards have not been that forward-thinking, and they have been doing, they've been trying to make as much money from producing those crops now as opposed to thinking about generations of their own family who might want to farm in the future.
It sounds like a Kansas version of the tragedy of the commons, that each irrigator can get a little more water out in order to enhance short-term profits at the expense of the future of the resource. And it's coming back to haunt us. How many years passed?
Right, and
our first Earth Day.
And I don't think most people take into account the role that the federal government is having, the influence that the federal government is having. I feel like the most important thing that can be done to preserve the aquifer is to change federal government policy so that we're not subsidizing those unsustainable crops, those irrigated crops, either with the ethanol mandate or with crop insurance now through the farm program.
Absolutely.
And instead replace those subsidies with something that is actually to the benefit of the taxpayers who are underwriting the bill, which would be to preserve the nation's largest aquifer, giving farmers money, for instance, to switch back to dry land agriculture, which was working wonderfully when we started irrigating.
And towards the end of the book, you do go into that, and the question of slow money, slow food, and doing things differently. So you offer the reader at least some alternative solutions to the problem, which was nice to get to towards the end of the book. But as I told the listeners, It isn't all about the technicalities of what's happening with the Ogallala as it's drawn down much faster than it can recharge. But it's also a personal journey for you, the Ogallala Road. And if you want to say something, you know, what did it mean to you writing this about your relationship with family, with the farm?
Well, it all goes back to water, because you can't live in the place I come from without water. And so when we started wasting the water, we actually were starting to undermine our own relationship to the place that had given us our identity. And our identity was very much grounded in our being dryland farmers. We knew how to preserve every last drop of moisture in the soil, and that's what made us who we were. We were used to living within limits, and that gave us our character, really. And so when we started taking the easy way out, when we started using a lot of chemicals, and we started irrigating, we started to think of the place more as a way to generate income as opposed to a way of life, and that our relationship to the place then gradually began to erode. But these are the people, and this is the place that's most important to me on Earth. It gave me my sense of aesthetics and, like I say, formed my character, and I just hate seeing it destroyed.
Well, for our listeners, the name of the book, again, is The Ogallala Road, written by Julene Bear. It's a memoir of love and reckoning, and you'll have to read the book to understand the love and reckoning part, as Julene struggles with her son and her dad and her mom and siblings on a farm in northwest Kansas. And we urge you to go listen to her. That is on Thursday, April 24th at 7 o'clock at Unity Temple on the Plaza here in Kansas City, hosted by Rainy Day Books and the Kansas Land Trust. Julene, thank you very much for your time, and I think we may be getting back to you when we talk about further about water resources and what's going on in Kansas. Good luck tonight on your book tour, and we'll talk to you later.
Wonderful. Thank you.
This week, making sense of last week's gunfire at two Jewish centers in Kansas.
They really aren't getting much into what they've learned about his motives yet. But I think it's telling, you know, that federal prosecutors say they're pursuing hate charges.
I'm Maureen Fiedler. That's next time on Interfaith Voices.
Tuesday at noon, right after your Fusion Funkmeister.
Tune in this Wednesday at noon for the All Souls Forum to hear Professor Robert W. McChesney talk about how the money is destroying the American electoral system. We're also going to hear how capitalism is turning the internet against democracy. Potent subjects and certainly very topical. Join us Wednesday, noon, right here on KKFI for the All Souls Forum.
Move to Amend founder David Cobb will speak at Pearson Hall, 5100 Rock Hill Road on the UMKC campus on Tuesday, April 22nd, 7 p.m. His speech will be entitled Challenging Corporate Power and Creating Democracy. Further details at kcmovetoamend.org. This message is a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome back to Eco Radio. This is Elaine Giesel, your host for the night. You're listening to KKFI 90.1 FM. We're going to be talking next to Joe Spees of the Sierra Club. Joe participated in a workshop in Wichita just this week, April 16th, that was called by the governor, Governor Brownback of Kansas, to look into issues related to earthquakes and fracking and disposal of waste down deep wells. Are you with us, Joe?
I'm right here. How are you doing, Elaine?
I'm fine. I'm glad you could join us tonight and kind of fill us in on what happened at that event, why the governor felt it was necessary to ask for such a task force, maybe who served on that task force, and maybe at the end we'll talk about an action item that people can actually submit comments. So why don't we start with what persuaded Governor Brownback to actually ask for this task force?
Well, we've been having earthquakes in large number. I remember when I first testified before an interim committee of the legislature, it was about 3 years ago, and I brought up the concern for, it's called induced seismicity. This is when something that mankind is doing results in an action that creates a problem. And in this case, this disposal of fluids from hydraulic fracturing, when they're injected into injection wells, they create earthquakes. And I'll explain more about that. But this interim committee laughed at me at the suggestion. And I said that it's really not funny, that we know that it's already happening. There's a history of this going back into the 1960s. In Colorado, there was the Rangeley episode, and there are a lot of historical events of a similar nature that should have given us a clue that this problem has potential. But now, down in south-central Kansas, and it's starting to move a little bit farther north into north-central Kansas, too. But in a 110-year period from 1887 to 1997, Kansas had 30 earthquakes reported. Now, in the six-month period through the end of March this year, the end of 2013 and into March, we've had, actually, it's over 200 earthquakes near these injection wells in south-central Kansas. None of them have been major, like one down in Oklahoma that registered 5.7 on the Richter scale, but we've had several above 3, and we know now that that size range of a seismic event, people are going to have cracked foundations and broken roofs and cracked highways, and there were enough complaints coming in to the governor's office and the legislature that the governor thought it would be a good idea to create a task force to study this idea a little more.
And the individuals who served on the task force and were there in Wichita on April 16th were whom?
It was primarily geologists. The lead presenters and the head of the task force is Rex Buchanan, who's the interim director of the Kansas Geological Survey. And then one of his assistants, Rick Miller, who has had the assignment of kind of studying the earthquakes in Kansas. But it was helpful that we had two people from the Oklahoma Geological Survey who were there, who could relate their experience where they've had some really bad problems in Oklahoma. They are doing a lot more hydraulic fracturing and a lot more disposal into the injection wells than we are at this point. So they've been using this this method that causes the problem. And then also an individual from the United States Geological Survey, Justin Bernstein. Then there were a lot of people there from the oil and gas industry. And then there were some concerned citizens. There were people, citizens from South Central Kansas who were coming in just to listen and hopefully have a chance to share their personal experiences. They didn't have that opportunity. This was a real managed task force meeting where they weren't really welcoming input during the presentations. There were breakout groups where they asked us to look at some four primary questions that we could respond to, and then those were put together and collected, and then we'll hear back from the leaders of the task force, mainly from the Geologic Survey, in about their response to the suggestions that people came up with. But that was really it. It was mainly the Geologic Survey. The oil and gas industry was there. There were there's a handful of legislators there, not that many, probably three or four, and then some concerned citizens.
Well, and for our listeners who may not know, it's the Kansas Corporation Commission, or the KCC, which has oversight of oil and gas drilling in Kansas. And also on the task force then was someone representing the Water Bureau, as I understand it, from the Kansas Department of Health and Environment. So it's a fairly broad group. But as you said, the stakeholders were invited to participate, although, I mean, you and I had some conversation. It was not a very transparent process. To try to get involved in this. I know I work with the League of Women Voters on doing a fracking study and trying to get some insights into what the agenda would be and how we could get our group involved. You know, we were limited to one individual, and as I understand it, Sierra Club had four individuals who attended, but this was really not an open type of meeting. It was, as you said, fairly controlled, and you had to have confirmation to even get in.
Yeah, it was kind of discouraging. You know, we're not the suggestions that we have. We're not out to get anybody. We're not out to get the oil and gas industry. Our primary concern is protecting Kansas citizens. And you know, I thought, and I'm sure others thought also, that because that is our primary concern, that our comments would be received a little more and welcomed a little bit more strongly. Right now, the oil and gas industry is on the defensive, and so I think there's a bit of an effort there to kind of protect them in a way and to prevent them from an assault by concerned citizens who have a lot of questions. And this is a very complex subject. Few people understand it, and I'll use one example as something that's very misleading. It's going to be very difficult to overcome. The oil and gas industry, in their promotional materials and ads and things like that, and on their websites and information they're providing, will tell people that hydraulic fracturing does not cause earthquakes. And, well, that's not exactly true in and of itself, because we know that it has, but they're very small. But it's the disposal of the fluids produced from hydraulic fracturing into these injection wells. That is the problem. So the process of hydraulic fracturing creates the need for disposal of these toxic fluids into these injection wells, and that's the problem. So to suggest that hydraulic fracturing isn't causing these earthquakes is really misleading, and it's creating a great deal of confusion in the public. So we have a job cut out for us in educating people so they understand the problem and how it is directly related to hydraulic fracturing.
You know, Joe, we have limited time tonight, and just so we don't get cut off before we give some important information, I did want to cover at least the fact that there is an opportunity now until May 16th at 5 o'clock, close of business May 16th, for the public to submit comments on a draft state action plan that addresses this induced seismicity, the earthquakes related, whether it's to fracking or whether it's to waste disposal. And the draft plan can be seen on the KCC website. You can easily Google that, Kansas Corporation Commission. It's at kcc.state.kansas.ks.us if you need, you know, a URL. When you get there, it's at the top of the page on recent news. It talks about this induced seismicity task force meeting, and if you click on that, it will take you to a page where you can access the draft state action plan. And the plan actually is kind of three-part. It's their preventive measures, there's the response to earthquakes, and there's the long-term monitoring. And there's kind of a tree, a response tree, if you will, that there are some gaps in that they're looking for public input. So if you're interested in getting involved in this, go to the KCC website. You'll be able to submit those comments by email to public.affairs@kcc.ks.gov, or you can even call them. There's a phone number given there. But you will need to go and look at the draft state action plan. And if you've got some input that you want to deliver, you have until May 16th to do so. There's also an abundance of materials that were used at the task force that are accessible via that site as well. So if you would like to do that, please, you know, get involved. This is an opportunity to do that. And I want to go back to Joe, because one of the things I know that we have been worried about is the fact that innocent landowners who have neither fracking wells on their property nor disposal wells on their property may be impacted by the earthquakes and suffer property damage. And maybe Joe can tell us, is there any way right now, other than the civil courts litigation, for a property owner to have, you know, to be repaid for, say, foundation damage or something?
No, and it's going to be really difficult to get insurance for this, too. As of now, and I was told, I asked this very question to representatives from the KCC, the Kansas Corporation Commission, and their reply was citizens can take their damage concerns into civil court. Well, it's going to be extremely difficult, if not impossible, for any single citizen to win a case against an oil and gas company, because it's very difficult to assign responsibility to an earthquake and damages from it to any one particular oil and gas company or when it happened. It's something that's almost impossible to prove on a technical basis. This is one where we're going to have to use all the available evidence to make sure that we know what's going on. Just the fact that the number of earthquakes that we've been having has increased exponentially. We know what is causing the problem. In Ohio, the regulatory agencies in Ohio just made the decision. They worked with their state geologic survey to conclude that this disposal of fracking fluids into these injection wells was indeed causing their earthquakes up there, and they've had very serious problems there, cracked gas lines, things that are really dangerous. And so they're now banning injection into those wells until anything can happen any further. So in Kansas, we have a problem with this cost issue. Who's going to pay for the damages to these homes? Who's going to pay for a cracked foundation? And how many households went around and videotaped their foundations to show that it wasn't cracked before this disposal into these injection wells took place? What we need is the cooperation of the KCC and the oil and gas industry so that we can get a fund established to help people cover these costs that insurance won't cover, and they don't really stand any chance of recouping through civil court. And not to do this will be to create this giant subsidy to the oil and gas industry from public citizens, because we'll eventually all pay for these damages being done one way or another. And it makes more sense to get the oil and gas industry to cooperate with us and establish a fund to help compensating these people who have suffered damages.
And right now, most of the activity, the fracking activity, is occurring in that in two or three counties, really, in south central Kansas. But the Mississippi Lime Play that they're extracting oil and gas from actually extends well into central Kansas. So in the future, if gas prices go back up, we may see expansion of this activity into areas closer to Wichita and some of the other cities, I imagine.
Yeah, for now, most of the fracking activity is for oil. They pretty much abandoned natural gas. They can't make money from that. But it doesn't make any difference. Fracking for oil or gas, the same problems occur. And in listening to your segment before we started talking, water use is an issue here, too. But the earthquakes represent a very, very serious problem for the people in central Kansas. And as you mentioned, going farther and farther north every day.
You know, one of the problems that we heard from the Kansas Geologic Survey was that they really aren't set up to identify earthquake epicenters and so on because they don't have a good monitoring system. Was this brought up at this meeting, and is there any hope of resolving that?
Yeah, well, one of our suggestions was, again, since this problem is the responsibility of the oil and gas industry, we suggested that the oil and gas industry chip in and help pay for additional monitors. And the Oklahoma geologists had already created a map that said if Kansas were smart, I'm not going to jump on that opportunity, we would put monitors, at least 8 monitors in the state, and then they drew the concentric circles to explain why positioning these monitors in these locations would give us the best information, the best data to use to monitor and solve this problem. And the United States Geological Survey said that they might be able to help with a couple, but one of our recommendations is going to be for the oil and gas industry to help cover the cost for the additional monitors needed.
No, excellent. I mean, those are two good points, that if someone wanted to send some comments to KCC, you know, getting an adequate monitoring system so it could actually be used in courts would be important, and also having some kind of damage fund that was paid for by the industry would certainly be helpful. Those are the kinds of things that public certainly would have an interest in supporting. You know, I don't know what's going on in Oklahoma. Maybe you can answer this, but the argument that we're not going to have serious problems here in Kansas is that by these wells being in the Arbuckle formation, they are gravity-fed disposal wells. They're not under high pressure, so we shouldn't have the problems they're having. Do you know in Oklahoma, are they using, you know, just gravity-fed disposal processes, or are they injecting under pressure?
Well, we were fortunate to have the United States Geologic Survey gentleman from San Francisco at this meeting, because he jumped all over that. Where there was a gentleman from the oil and gas industry, he's a geoscience advisor to the oil and gas industry, who did a presentation and suggested that because of the Arbuckle Formation's depth the fact that we weren't really injecting at pressures above 500 psi, that really wouldn't be much of an issue. And the representative from the USGS jumped all over it and said that is a completely wrong assertion. He said the pressure, the injection pressure, has nothing to do with this problem. He said when once you have the right formation, and it requires kind of an elbow formation where you have one fault running along, if you're to make a 90-degree angle with your arm, once your elbow, the top part of your arm hits that other, if you have a geologic formation like that where you have a horizontal fault and a vertical fault connecting, you don't really need these fluids to be injected at pressure, and depth means nothing either. As long as if you have that combination of those fluids and that particular type of formation, you can get devastating earthquakes. And so the USGS individual really kind of shot down that argument from the oil and gas industry that we're not going to have problems here. He made it clear that everything that's happening here has just as much potential for serious earthquakes as any place else in the country.
Well, thank you for clarifying that, Joe, because that has been one of the arguments that we've heard, that we're not going to have the problems here in Kansas. I just want to make sure that folks know, again, they have an opportunity to enter public comment, and I'll tell you, the more people who comment, the more that the Kansas Corporation Commission is going to understand the public has serious concerns about this. You know, take the time to do this, folks. In your email or if you're going to make the phone call, you want to reference what's called the state action plan, and they will get the message. As Joe has pointed out, we're worried about who's going to help pay for damages on folks who are not getting any breaks from, say, a lease agreement, but are suffering damage. We don't want the public having to subsidize the industry to help, you know, remediate because our insurance prices are going up. We certainly want to see a better monitoring system in place so that we know what's going on. I mean, that's the basics here. So take yourself to the Kansas Corporation Commission website, kcc.state.ks.us. Should be on the front page when it opens up. You should be able to see something on the Induced Seismicity Task Force. And if you click on, you know, one of the drop down tabs, you will see the state action plan, the draft state action plan. You have until May 16th to do this, 5 o'clock. Do submit your comments. Joe, we very much appreciate your taking time to report to us on what went on in Wichita. And some, you know, I'm glad we had someone from USGS there to add to the discussion and so on. We'll get you back on sometime. We have a program coming up, I think, in May to talk about water issues in Kansas, and I certainly want you on board when we talk about fracking and what's going on with water. Thanks for tuning in tonight. We have another segment coming up. Mike Murphy has done an interview with Jill Stein. That's coming up, and I'm going to turn over the mic now to Natural E, who's going to talk to us about upcoming events.
Thanks, Elaine. In Lawrence, Kansas, the 14th Annual Earth Day Parade and Celebration featuring the Water Festival is Saturday, April 19th. Oh, no. Okay, well, I hope some of our listeners got to go to that Earth Day Festival. We have one coming up in Missouri celebrating Earth Day. It's called Earth Walk, and it's on May 3rd. It starts at 8 a.m. for the walk registration and festivities, and the walk starts at 9 a.m. And bridgingthegap.org is where you can register for this event. And in conjunction with their walk, Stone Lion Puppet Theater will be hosting a festival to celebrate the Earth. Bring the whole family for a fun day of activities and all in the beautiful city market. There will be a native plant sale by Missouri Prairie Foundation April 26th, this coming Saturday, from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the city market, 5th and Walnut in Kansas City, and the sale will benefit the Missouri Prairie Foundation with plants supplied by the Applied Ecological Services of Baldwin City, Kansas, and Forest Keeling Nursery of Aylesbury, Missouri. Native plants will include wildflowers, grasses, sedges, vines, trees, bushes, and ground covers. The March Against Monsanto Kansas City Edition will meet at the J.C. Nichols Fountain at 47th and Broadway, right on the plaza. And this takes place Thursday, April 24th at 1 p.m. And as Elaine mentioned earlier, our guest author on today's show will be speaking at Unity Temple on April 24th, this Thursday at 7 p.m. And let's see, Wednesday, April 23rd at 6:30 p.m. at the Central Library in downtown Kansas City, there will be a talk called The Meat Racket about the secret takeover of America's food business, and the speaker will be Christopher Leonard. And those are the events I have for today. Coming up is Mike Murphy speaking with Jill Stein.
I have on the phone with me Dr. Jill Stein. Dr. Stein is a mother, physician, longtime teacher of internal medicine, and pioneering environmental health advocate. She co-authored two widely praised reports, In Harm's Way, Toxic Threats to Child Development, published in 2000, and Environmental Threats to Healthy Aging, published in 2009. In 2002, she was recruited by the Green Party of Massachusetts to run for governor, where she was widely considered the most credible and knowledgeable candidate in that race, Mitt Romney being one of the other candidates. In 2012, she became the Green Party's presidential candidate. Since that election, her and her running mate, Sherry Hunkela have not slowed down. Dr. Stein, welcome to Eco Radio KC.
Thank you. It's great to be with you, Mike.
We really appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to speak to us about some of the things going on.
Thank you.
You've got this Mother Earth Day to May Day, People,
right.
Planet, Peace over Profit, the Global Climate Convergence. First off, why are you doing this?
I think we're at a very historic moment right now. The climate obviously is in grave danger. We the people are in grave danger on account of the climate. Our lives, our well-being, our economies, our food production, sea level rise, storms, you name it. We're in the target hairs right now. At the same time, we're seeing the economy continue to not just stall, but really to serve the 1%, while most other people are, being thrown under the bus. Jobs are being exported. Wages continue to slide, and the cost of living continues to skyrocket. People are in debt. Students are coming out of college with, enormous burdens that they cannot repay because the jobs aren't there. The jobs that are being created are low wage, et cetera. So, we have basically two emergencies, an ecological emergency and an economic emergency, and you might say there's a democracy emergency on top of it all. So, a lot of us activists who've been here fighting the fight for a while looked around and said, this isn't working. We really have the capacity to truly change course here. There's an enormous surge of activism, of democracy and justice really sweeping the planet right now, but we need to get together. We've been divided up into silos. It's a game of divide and conquer right now. It's the environment against the economy, among many other divisions. What if we all got together? And that was the essential spark for this, the realization that if we got together all the people who want to see a sustainable climate, who want jobs, who want living wages, who want to end student debt, if you started putting us together, we have more than a majority to change course. And we see this in poll after poll. We also see it in the incredible upsurge of activism happening around the globe right now. So, it was the understanding that we have a crisis, but also the understanding that we have the power to fix it. We have the solutions. We have critical mass. We have the inspiration. Nothing like the present moment. That's really what inspires us. And as we began to put the word out there about it, it was absolutely astonishing to see how people were ready to take this and run with it.
You framed it as the environment versus the economy. Is it that stark a choice? Is it an either-or situation that we have to pick what side we're on?
Well, that's what we're being presented with. We're supposed to choose. Do you want jobs? Or do you want a water supply? Do you want the jobs fracking methane and oil reserves and so on, breaking up the deep rock beneath our feet and intruding on our water supplies in a big way? You're going to harm the environment if you want jobs. That's how it's being put to us. But the reality is, if you contaminate our water supplies, if you heat up the climate so much that we're all in a state of drought, which is a critical issue right now for the U.S. and around the world, then we don't have an economy. The economy crumbles, and our factories and stores are all closed because there is no fuel to run the engines. There is no water to cool the engines, no food to feed the people, et cetera. It's preposterous to think that we have to choose. And in fact, we know we can create three times as many jobs in the clean, renewable energy sector as we do in the fossil fuel or nuclear sector. You create three times as many by cleaning up, by preventing pollution, basically. We also prevent a whole host of health problems, and it pours money back into our economy. We save so much money in converting to clean, renewable energy from the sicknesses that are prevented by going clean and green, that it more than pays for the transition. So it's absolutely false to say that we have to have one or the other. And in fact, that's how the powers that be frame it, because that's the only way they can put the brakes on this transformation to a solar-powered, wind-powered, geothermal-powered economy that really serves people, our health, our jobs, and our future. It's there. All we have to do is stand up and insist on it and reject this false idea that it's a choice between the environment and the economy.
So you've created a nice little chronological frame in that discussion, because you're starting out tomorrow on Earth Day and ending on May Day. And quite often the environmental movement and the labor movement are pit against each other. Is this an attempt to maybe diffuse some of that?
Absolutely. You know, we are very much pitted against each other, because the minute we get together, we're absolutely unstoppable. And we're beginning to see this happen. The idea in creating an Earth Day to May Day event, so-called 10 days to change course, a wave of action, is to bring labor folks to Earth Day and to bring Earth Day folks to Labor Day, and to make the point that this is a continuum of justice. Earth Day, or as we call it now, Mother Earth Day, is a day to celebrate and to protect the planet and the ecosystems that we depend on traditionally. And Labor Day traditionally is the day to celebrate working people and immigrants, and to assert the rights of those groups as human rights. Our thinking was, let's point out that this is a continuum of justice. You cannot have justice for the planet unless you're also having justice for the people. And why is that? If you neglect human needs, people will chop down the forests, they will overfish the oceans, they will overgraze our farmland, etc., our grazing pastures. The ecosystems will be destroyed in the effort to meet human needs if we haven't planned for the two together. They must work in harmony. So the idea is, let's connect the dots here along the continuum of justice. You know, it's funny, because if you talk to everyday people about it, mothers and fathers and kids, they totally understand that these things are all connected, that we cannot have jobs in an economy unless we have the sustainable energy, the climate, freedom from devastating storms and drought and so on, that these two naturally go together. But it's the interest groups who sort of have their own agendas to push that dominate the airwaves, especially the deep-pocketed special interests, the fossil fuel companies, the nuclear and the fracking companies and so on, you know, who have these ginormous budgets to put out the huge advertising propaganda campaigns that they use. They buy off the politicians and our mainstream big political parties who are all serving their agenda. So it's pounded into our brains that this is a divided situation and we can't get together. But the minute we do, it's incredible. Last week, there was a major labor conference in Chicago called Labor Notes, which was the biggest it has ever been. It was thousands of people. And the buzz in the conference was all about this getting together of the climate and labor. And there are some wonderful groups and institutions that have really been pushing the envelope, and people are beginning to wake up to the reality. No one is more in the target here, actually, of fossil fuel and their impact on the climate than working people. Workers on fossil fuel projects, on gas fracking, on oil rigs, and so on, their mortality is actually increased 700% over your usual job. They are really in harm's way because of all the explosions, the poisons, the heavy equipment, and so on. They pay a huge price for this energy system, which is not only killing them, you know, it's killing their communities and poisoning their water supplies. And when the storms hit, who's on the front line? It's low-income and working people and people of color who pay the biggest price with their health, their lives, and their homes. When you have the Katrinas and the Superstorm Sandy, the Super Typhoon Haiyans, and these are the wave of the future. So working people are beginning to wake up to this and to really shake up their leadership and insist that they start standing up for them, not these kind of traditional comfort relationships with the Democratic Party and all the fossil fuel and nuclear money that pours into that party to basically stay the course and support the status quo. you know, this is exactly why we the people need to get together, because there are solutions here for working people, for low-income people, for students, for people who are losing their homes. What we've done is say Earth Day to May Day is the launch. We're standing up, and we're standing up on whatever issue is critical to you. It doesn't have to be climate. It can be the pollution of your water supply. It can be the power plant that's polluting your air. It can be the bank that is foreclosing on your neighborhood. It can be the fast food establishments that are underpaying your workers. It could be your local chamber of commerce, who is one of the biggest lobbyists out there supporting these enormous abusive so-called free trade, they should be called corporate trade agreements, that are sending our jobs overseas. All of these things are interconnected. So we're encouraging people to stand up on whatever issue is critical to you and get out there for your local concern. And while you're there, bring out your sign, People, Planet, and Peace Over Profit. Slap the logo on it, which is just the child's hand holding the earth, and voila, we have a unified movement, and we are infinitely stronger together. In fact, we're unstoppable. We now have well over 200 events in over 50 cities and several countries now outside of the U.S. as well. It's amazing how this thing has taken on a life of its own. So many of the Occupy groups are coming out to re-inhabit their Occupy sites. Some of them are establishing food tents to feed the hungry, you know, to assert that the rights of people and the rights of the planet go hand in hand. There are food tents, for example, in Seattle, Portland, in Philadelphia. There's a big effort to feed hungry families on Earth Day. Food is a truly unifying ecological and community issue. In New York, for Earth Day, there will be a parade. You know, and traditionally, Earth Day has been the day when corporations roll out their greenwashing agendas and their so-called green products while they continue to trample the environment. So we're using Earth Day to actually call out the corporations. Instead of make nice with them, we're calling out the corporations who are actually destroying the planet. In New York, the parade will be going to the offices of BP and to some of the banks that are financing the fossil fuel and nuclear destruction. Many cities around the country are hosting species parades where people dress up as the species who are in the target here, including the humans, for example. So humans are part of these parades of species at risk, and they walk with a code of silence to, you know, convey the solemnity of the occasion. So it's both a celebration as well as a kind of solemn ritual. In Nashville, there is a Nashville Pipeline Make Dance, where they have a 50-foot pipeline made out of hula hoops and garbage bags that they will be dancing with, along with a New Orleans marching band. There's just any number of actions. One other I should mention, this one, we're holding three solidarity events. So what you want to do, actually, is go to globalclimateconvergence.org, the website. There's a calendar there, and you can select on the calendar a city near you and see if there are events planned. If there aren't, you can be your own event. And, in fact, you can register on the calendar, too, to put yourself on the map. And those events include all kinds of things. There are three particular events that we're encouraging everybody to get out and do. On the 25th, there is a general solidarity event for People, Planet, and Peace Over Profit. We're working with the Overpass Light Brigade. These are groups of people all around the country, actually all around the world, who get out with these beautiful, luminous signage, and they create using these very large letters that are all lit up with Christmas tree lights. They create these meaningful words and messages. There may be a light brigade near you to congregate with, or you can just get out with your own sign, or just get out with a candle and hold a vigil. We're encouraging everybody, take your picture and then upload it on our website and be part of the gallery of shining light all over the nation, you know, 1,000 points of light that are all coming together into a laser focus for people, planet, and peace. So that's one event on the 25th. There's another event on the 28th, which is on the theme of no dirty fuel, renewables now. And you can get out with that sign and, again, take your picture and upload it. Let your neighbors and friends know by registering the event in advance on the calendar. So that way other people in your city can find you. Now just choose a park or visible public space or even an overpass over a highway if you have luminous light, and put yourself on the calendar and be a part of that solidarity event. And then on May 1st, on May Day, we're having a celebration of immigrant rights as workers' rights, as human rights. So those are three particular events where people are joining in all over the country. One other thing to mention, there's also a climate fast going on. It's the last United Nations climate conference in Warsaw. The representative from the Philippines, whose home was devastated by Superstorm Haiyan, started a climate fast, really, in protest to the failure of the UN process to move forward, really a protest to say we demand much more. And he is participating in our climate fast. There are many ways that you can participate, and all of us together, you know, just create an unstoppable momentum for people, planet, and peace over profit. This is the beginning. We're stressing. This is the time to get involved, and we will carry on from there. Stay tuned and be a part of it.
I do want to let our listeners know that another former Green Party presidential candidate will be here in Kansas City tomorrow, Earth Day. David Cobb is here for a Move to Amend event, and that will take place at UMKC. And again, that's framing it around this, the term that's been used before, Blue-Green Alliance. Before we let you go, Dr. Stein, I want to also make sure our listeners know that you'll be coming to Kansas City in the middle of June. Can you maybe spend a minute on that?
Yes. Green parties are part of this, you know, this revival, this spirit of democracy and justice that is really sweeping the globe as well as the country. And in the last couple of years, we've seen green parties established where they've never been, and we've seen them revive where they had kind of gone dormant over the very oppressive decade of the 2000s. We're seeing people really stand up against this politics of fear that has told us you have to just kind of go along to get along and embrace the lesser evil. You know, people have seen where that pathway leads. And what we've seen coming out of the current White House, you know, is a good example of worse war, worse exporting of our jobs, worse attack on labor, on our civil liberties, on immigrant rights, you know, coming out of the current White House than out of the former Republican White House. So, you know, it's been a real demonstration that we need a politics of courage, not a politics of fear. That has brought us all the things that we were afraid of, all those reasons we were supposed to, you know, be quiet and settle for the lesser evil. We've gotten now just by the droves. So it's a real revival now of the politics of courage. And as part of that, there will be a four-party revival, I guess you could say, going on in Kansas City that will involve Kansas, Missouri, Nebraska, and Iowa. I believe it's a 2 or 3 day event, and I'm really excited to be there and to help support redevelopment and revival of the green parties in these four states.
That's great. And so it's June 13th to 15th at the Heartland Presbyterian Center, which is in Parkville, Missouri. And there's a Facebook event page called Transforming Politics on the Prairie, Building the Green Party in the Midwest. So, Dr. Stein, I can't thank you enough for joining us on Eco Radio KC.
It's been great to be with you, Mike. Wonderful talking with you.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Están escuchando KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City.